Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been called the crisis within the crisis, the emotional and physical toll of coronavirus restrictions on elderly Americans. Many who live in facilities felt cut off for months from the outside world due to rules designed to protect them from the virus. Now, though, both federal and state authorities have released guidelines for how and when these facilities can allow visits and other activities. Still, there's lots of variation depending upon the facility itself and the community surrounding it. Today in The Exchange, we find out more and look broadly at how the places and the people who care for our elders are constantly adjusting. Listeners, let's hear your experiences with this, whether you're a long-term care resident yourself, a staff member, or someone with a loved one in a facility. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer for the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Also, Judy Joy, Statewide Coordinator for the COVID Alliance Senior Support Team. That's a volunteer group to support long-term care facilities during the pandemic. Judy is also a licensed registered nurse with a doctorate degree in educational leadership. And Dr. Daniel Stadler is with us, Director of Geriatrics at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's medical director at 4 skilled nursing facilities in the Upper Valley. Well, a big welcome to all of you. And Judy, I want to start with you because your group is in wide touch with people who work at facilities around the state. How would you, Judy, describe the toll of this pandemic on elder care facility residents and staff, both from the illness itself and the isolation that stemmed from protective measures?
Oh, that's an incredibly interesting question, Laura. Interesting. Since midsummer, when the state began to consider easing restrictions on contact, our facilities have been telling us that they need permission for hairdresser visits, which we thought was rather odd. But it wasn't that haircuts were so necessary, but that the residents were starved for human interaction, for someone to actually touch them in, you know, in a way that was different than their daily caregivers. And we're hearing now how facility administrators are struggling with that balance between resident safety and their quality of life. The residents we're hearing about are declining in physical and mental capacity because they have no or they have little interaction, and that's a tragedy. And the facilitators, the facilities, and the staff are struggling with that. They're really feeling impacted. The recent phased reopening guidance issued by the state has been a move in the right direction for them.
What kind of variation, Judy, are you hearing about around the state? And I'll use my own family as an example. I don't normally do that, but my mother's facility in Keene and my dad's facility in Manchester seem to have very different policies when it comes to visitation. So how much variety are you seeing, Judy?
There's a broad variety, as there should be. The communities that they reside in, and their experience with staff exposure would be very, very different, and so they should be different, and that's of course one of the things that that the facility administrators are struggling with is that it's always more comforting to say this is what you should do, and in this circumstance that's not something that either the state or the federal government can tell any individual facility. It's their experience, their level of staffing, their PPE availability. All of those things contribute to whether or not they can or should open their facility or be more restrictive.
Well, Melissa, last time when we spoke in May, and welcome back and thank you, you said you were concerned about opening up to visitors. Again, that was in May. How are you feeling now, Melissa?
So I think obviously there's always going to be some concern. The facilities and the department are expressing concern at all times about the health and safety of these residents. And so it's always going to be a concern. We're always going to be worried about COVID and the spread of and opening to visitors, but there is a balance that needs to be met. And, you know, the psychosocial well-being of these individuals that are in nursing homes and their ability to connect with their loved ones is important. And it's just such a huge benefit to them physically, mentally, and to have those visitors. So, you know, I think there needs to be that balance. And although there is always going to be, you know, some apprehension, I think we need to be able to allow them to have that visitation so that they can maintain, you know, that kind of well-being state for them, for their health.
And Melissa, what's the range of readiness for more visitation? Because as you know, there's a wide array of facilities from county nursing homes to upscale assisted living communities. So how would you describe the range of readiness for more visitation?
So I think all of them have been contemplating this for months, and they all of the facilities knew that we would get to a point where facilities would need to open up to visitors. And so I you know, in asking facilities and having conversations with facilities about what is the best thing to do, because each facility is structured differently and has different outdoor spaces and indoor spaces. So I think that, you know, they've all put together policies that apply to their facility and how they can accomplish the visitation for their residents. So each of them is really prepared to move forward and implement those policies to ensure safety.
And Melissa, where do those policies come from? Because I'm still not clear on sort of who says, you know, you can do this, nursing homes and assisted living facilities, you cannot do that. Is it you guys at DHHS? Is it the Centers for Medicare Services, or who is it?
So CMS came out with recommendations. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services came out with recommendations a couple of months ago,
right?
And established a phased approach to reopening facilities. And After reviewing that phased approach, we felt in New Hampshire that we wanted to create, through our Department of Public Health, to work with them and see what's the best for New Hampshire, knowing we're a smaller state and you know, our counties are all situated very differently. And so the department did come up with guidance for nursing homes, but that guidance is in line with what CMS had come out with. You know, there are some variations, but generally it is in line. And so recently, after we put out our guidance, just recently over the last week and a half or so, CMS came out with another guidance document related specifically to visitation to address those psychosocial needs of the residents. And so, you know, right now the department is reviewing that document and our guidance document that went out to see if there is any discrepancy. Generally, it looks very similar. You know, outdoor visitation when able, and then indoor visitation for certain things. So I think that the department right now is working through that. Public Health, our Bureau of Licensing and Certification, who's responsible for the regulatory oversight of these facilities, they're looking at it together as a team to say, is there something that we put out in our guidance that is in contradiction of the CMS guidance? And so so that's what's being worked on right now. And I would say that both, you know, the nursing homes have to follow certification rules and regulations. They have to follow the CMS regulations. And we want to make sure that when we put something out, it is not in contradiction of those things.
Well, Dr. Stadler, to you, first of all, what's been the impact of this pandemic, including the social isolation that our other two guests have mentioned? What has that meant for the residents and also the staff, Dr. Stadler?
Yeah, you know, I would just echo what others have said, the psychosocial burden on our residents, and quite honestly on our staff, has been really significant. From the perspective of the residents, it's the social isolation, it's the lack of physical touch, it's the not being able to see a face and read lips if there's a hearing impairment. And for the staff, I think there's a sort of an existential struggle of, you know, in the name of saving lives, am I making people's lives worse? Many of the residents of these facilities, I have no doubt, if asked, would say, I would choose a shorter life if I could visit with my daughter. You know, these are the last years of my life, and to spend it this way is not the way I want to do it. And so are we helping or are we hindering? I think the other big issue is, you know, not just psychosocial implications, but the health implications. People eat better when their families come and visit. I have patients who are losing significant amounts of weight since the pandemic hit. We know that older population get huge benefit from even small amounts of exercise. And yet when you confine people to their rooms, they simply can't walk down the hall the way they used to. And that has major health implications. So I think we are in a situation where we are trying to choose between the lesser of two evils every day.
Well, it's heartbreaking, Dr. Stadler. And again, I have personal experience with this. You know, you're right. Most of these folks are in the last months or years of their lives. Is this really how they want to spend it, sitting in a room all by themselves? On the other hand, from the facility perspective, and I'm going to ask you this, Dr. Stadler, since you're medical director at four skilled nursing facilities, nobody wants to be that COVID facility. You know what I mean? Nobody wants that headline. That's terrible for people who live there currently, people who work there, and also it's bad PR. So I just wonder how you're sort of sorting through that.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to suggest that these restrictions are inappropriate. You're absolutely right. When this disease hits a residential care facility, it is devastating. It is catastrophic. And it's catastrophic for everyone involved. And so we need to do everything we can within reason to protect against that. However, we have to balance that with the well-being of our patients and ask the families and the residents to sort of bear with us, I think, a little bit as we try to struggle through this unwinnable situation, if you will.
So, Dr. Stadler, without going into excruciating detail, give us a general sense, please, of how visitation is going right now. Melissa and Judy mentioned that there are some new guidelines, came out about a week ago, that do allow more visitations.
Sure. So in the early stages, we were in total lockdown. That meant that we could only accept residents once they had had a negative COVID test. And then they were put in 14 days of complete isolation, meaning they could not interact with other residents, they did not come out of their room, and anyone who went in to see them was in full PPE. No family could visit, only essential personnel could go in and out of the building, and only with appropriate screening. That was what the state is called phase zero. Mm-hmm. We then moved to phase one, where we have been now allowed to do outdoor visits with family members. There are restrictions about what needs to be worn. It has to be 6 feet apart, and it has to be supervised. So somebody from the facility has to monitor that visit and ensure that the guidelines are upheld. And so you can imagine the scheduling of these visits and the supervision of these visits takes a big toll on the staffing. These are tasks that were not typically done in the past, and so now we have to add that to the list as well as the regular care for patients. That's phase one. In the Upper Valley, due to the incidence of the disease, we're now able to consider phase two, which would allow one family member considered an essential support visitor to come in to the building and help with some of the care of the patient. I would say that though that's an option, many of the facilities that I've been involved with and many of the facilities that I know of have not elected to implement phase two due to the considerable risk.
That's interesting. Even though it's now allowed to have a designated essential support visitor, basically one person who can go inside, a lot of places, Dr. Stadler, are deciding not to do that.
At least currently. I think that we may see some changes in that as the weather gets colder, because the opportunities to do these outdoor visits is going to be harder.
Well, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We'd love to hear from you this hour as we check back in with the state's long-term care system and how the visitation rules and guidelines have been changing a little bit just recently. Tell us your experiences, whether you work at a facility or you live in one or you have a loved one who is living in a nursing home or some other type of long-term care facility. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. So speaking of indoor visits and these new designated essential support visitor, that's the term. I have an email here from Jamie. It's a little long, but I want to read it because I think it really shows what family members are going through. Jamie says, my sister, age 56, is in a long-term care facility due to a health condition. It has now been 7 months since she's been able to leave the facility for any reason. For 7 months now, Jamie says, I have sent cards, celebrated her birthday through the window, dug out old family photos to mail her, sent her whimsical gifts, done a fashion show on Google Chat so she could pick out summer drop off, sent a lot of special food items, funny videos, anything I can think of to keep her spirits up. Then Jamie says, just this past Sunday, since I am now a quote, designated essential support visitor, I was able to visit her in her room for 2 hours, only to have that opportunity swept away as a staff member tested positive for the virus. For a few short hours, we felt a bit of normalcy. Now, Jamie says, she has to quarantine in her room again for 14 days. This is heart-wrenching, and to think that a person has to be confined to a room that is 12 by 12 for 14 days is almost inhuman. All it takes is one person to test positive, and we have to go back to the most restrictive phase. Jamie, thank you for writing, and our very best wishes to you and your sister. And Melissa, if I could go to you first, please. This email makes me wonder, what is the protocol? You know, one positive test, definitely alarming. Does that justify locking everyone else down? And go ahead, Melissa.
Yes, thank you. So it is heartbreaking. That story is heartbreaking, and it is heartbreaking for so many of the residents that are in these long-term care facilities. So the CDC does say that an outbreak is just one case. And so in following that CDC guidelines, the facilities are required to do certain things based off of the CMS regulations that are put in place at this time. And those include, quarantining and other things. So unfortunately, it does impact, just one case may have a huge impact on the nursing facility and their ability to allow visitors inside the facility. And it is, as Dr. Stadler was saying earlier, it's unfortunate that, there's this balancing. It's kind of which is the lesser of two evils. You know, we need to protect individuals from COVID. And then we also need to keep in mind their psychosocial well-being. It's really a tough balance, but at this time, nursing homes are bound by CMS regulations, and the CDC guidelines say that an outbreak is one case. So unfortunately,
Yeah, is there a difference between a nursing home and an assisted living facility and an elder care facility? We're sort of lumping them all together, but are there differences, or do those guidelines, those rules that you just mentioned apply to everybody?
So the most assisted living facilities are not certified by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, so are not bound by those regulations.
Oh, I see.
So nursing homes are really those that are bound by those regulations, and any assisted living that does accept any kind of Medicare or Medicaid funding. So apart from that, if it's a privately owned assisted living facility, they would be responsible for following the guidance put out by the Division of Public Health.
That's interesting. So nursing homes are bound by those federal Medicare guidelines. Assisted living facilities, where people are a little more independent and maybe there's a lower tier of medical care, Melissa, they have different rules.
They have different rules, but I shouldn't say they have different rules. They're not bound by the regulatory arm of CMS.
I see.
They are, though. They, you know, when we prepare our guidance, we use CDC guidelines, and the CDC right now is one individual is considered an outbreak. So that it would be in our guidance that we put towards assisted living facilities, and we try to treat them the same and have this, you know, we're using still the CDC guidelines to oversee what assisted living facilities are doing.
Judy, how familiar does this email from Jamie sound to you?
Oh, it is from, you know, from the calls that we make to our facility administrators. We have a lot of those stories. They are treading a very, very difficult balance, and many of them want, and I'm putting words into their mouth. Please understand that. But I believe that many of them do want a more open facility, but they also are very very aware of how the burden of safety. They want to keep their residents safe. So it is. It's heartbreaking on both sides, for the family and for the people inside who care for their residents. I think in most cases it's not just a business. It's a caring relationship with facility administrators, facility staff, and their residents.
Well, Judy, last question for you, please. And I want to let listeners know, we've got a link on our website to your organization if people want to know more about this volunteer group, senior support team. What's one change that you'd like to see, Judy, in the next few months, especially given worries about a fall surge, but especially the real need for elders to be with their loved ones? We've all seen the physical and cognitive and mental health declines.
Well, we know that all of the nuance of the language and the guidelines has been very confusing for facilities. You know, communication is imperfect at best, and so facilities are struggling with how do I interpret this and how can I meet the guidelines and still be as open as I possibly can. So being in the middle, so to speak, you know, our job as the Alliance has been to push out information to facilities, and so we've been able to do that. So being more open with the nuance and how that how the language applies to individual facilities would be very helpful.
Would more testing, Judy, help if there was sort of daily, you know, 30-minute turnaround testing time? Would that be helpful?
Oh, I think all three of us would say that would be absolutely a help. The impact of delayed testing, it sounds like it's fairly constrained. Okay, so you can't test, but it has an impact on the staff. The staff may have to go home, which means that there's not enough staff at a facility to care for individual patients. It means the use of PPE that is now costing more money for individual facilities. So it has a ripple effect. The delay of testing has been a dramatic impact, very dramatic impact. So yes, if we had a 30-minute or a 40, even a one day, would be an enormous improvement. And we do get some of that. We do get some of that, which so we know there's some capability there. It's just not enough.
Judy, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Laura. And volunteer. People volunteer. Thank you.
That's Judy Joy, statewide coordinator for the COVID Alliance Senior Support Team of New Hampshire, a volunteer group to support long-term care facilities during the pandemic. Judy's also a licensed registered nurse with a doctorate degree in educational leadership. She served as a medical surgical nurse in the Army. And like I said, we have linked to her organization on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Well, coming up, I'd like to talk a little bit more about testing, how extensive it is now, whether more would help, whether that would be a game changer as we head into the fall. We'll also talk to Doug McNutt, a longtime advocate for seniors here in the state, and we'll take a lot more of your calls and emails. You can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're checking back on New Hampshire's long-term care system. After tight restrictions for residents this spring due to COVID-19, new visitation guidelines have been released recently in recognition of the severe mental and physical health effects of isolation on seniors. We are finding out more this hour, and we've been hearing from you. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. Along with Melissa St. Cyr and Dr. Daniel Stadler, we're joined now by Doug McNutt, Associate State Director for Advocacy for AARP and former Director of the New Hampshire Bureau of Elderly and Adult Services. And welcome back, Doug. Nice to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, I'd like to actually start off this segment with a call from a listener. Marlene is joining us from Hinsdale. Hi, Marlene. You're on the air. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening to your program this morning and wanted to share that, as everyone knows how difficult this is, my mother is in Applewood Nursing Home in Winchester, New Hampshire, with Parkinson's disease. She's 81 years old. She's nearing the end of life. It's been very difficult to do just window visits. Though we have some fun times doing them. But it's hard because the Parkinson's has taken her speech from her. Outdoor visits are more frustrating, actually, because I cannot hear what she's trying to tell me. I have four sisters, three of which live in the area, so she gets plenty of window company. My question was, this is the first time I'd heard about a support person being able to go in and be actually physically near her. Is this something new?
Yeah, and let's ask our guests about that. And Doug McNutt, I'll turn to you. This is new, Marlene. Just about a week ago, I think on the 18th, there were some new guidelines released. And Doug, can you tell Marlene a little bit more about that?
Well, I'm certainly aware of it. I think Melissa can follow up on me. But what has been happening, I think what has happened from the beginning is there was such a lockdown in the beginning. And I don't know that anybody really anticipated that this would go on for as long as it has, to 6 or 7 months. What we're seeing now is a little bit of loosening up of the guidelines from both the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and also the state of New Hampshire. And it also sort of depends on where the facility is located, because I think Melissa kind of indicated earlier on, it depends upon the community in which the facility is in, what the transmission rates are within that particular community. So those are things that are important. But yes, there has been a balancing and there's the ability for that individual caregiver to go in. Now, I think Melissa can probably follow up on that in terms of, you know, how it is exactly being implemented within the state at this point.
Yeah, Melissa, can you jump in there? And I should say, you know, I keep hearing that the community in which the facility is located plays a big role. Hinsdale, in the western part of the state, there's not a lot of cases there. So, Melissa, you may not be able to comment on a specific institution, but can you just help us figure out this new guideline and why it doesn't seem to be applicable everywhere?
Yeah, so we are reviewing the cases in the county in which a facility would would reside. And so if the county is at a below or at a certain percentage positive, then that county can either move up or move down in a phase. And certainly as we see the southern tier of our state have, you know, a lot of positive tests, we would maybe move up a county or move down a county. In addition to the county review, then it also could be facility specific based off of that facility's outbreak status, you know, their history of positives of COVID, how long it's been since they had a COVID positive in their facility. So there is, there's an analysis on a county level and then a facility specific level as well.
I see, Melissa. So facilities can allow this designated person to come in, but they don't have to based on their own comfort levels.
Well, it depends on, I mean, they have to follow the CMS regulations. So if it's a nursing home, so if they're in a certain phase, you know, the regulatory oversight of that would be, okay, you've moved into a certain phase. Now, are you allowing for that visitation? And if you aren't allowing for the visitation, how are you substituting that? Because CMS is very concerned about, and obviously the department and the state as well, very concerned about the social emotional well-being of these residents. So if there's a reason that they're not moving forward, what is that reason? And is it because there's been some other type of impact to the facility that, you know, not every resident or not every family member might know about, or maybe they just haven't moved a phase and they're, you know, they're just, they're on the cusp of moving to the next phase or whatnot. So there's just some communication that needs to occur between the facility and the family members as to why they're in a certain phase, why they're doing what they're doing, and then obviously being in line with CMS regulations as well.
And Dr. Stadler, before the break, I asked Judy about testing and how much that would be helpful in terms of visitation, in terms of things not being quite so restrictive that elders really suffer. What are the testing, what's the testing availability at the facilities that that you are the medical director for, Dr. Stadler? How available is testing for residents and staff?
Thank you. Sure. So testing has actually, our access to testing has improved significantly over the last several months, as I think it has throughout the country. In the facilities where I work, all staff are tested once weekly, and approximately 10% of all residents are screened at the same time every week. That is typically done via PCR, which is sent to a lab. The turnaround time is about 24 to 48 hours for those tests. If we were to have rapid testing, if we were able to have daily testing, that would be a huge, huge game changer for our facility and for the access for patients. To the earlier email that you read, you know, a positive test is not a positive test is not a positive test. So first question, is the individual symptomatic or are they not? Second, how exposed have they been to other members of the community? A positive test in a resident who's been in isolation and hasn't gotten out of their room is very different than a positive test for an aide who's been, you know, walking from room to room to room to room. And then was she sneezing, was she coughing, or was this utterly asymptomatic? And so a fast test would really reduce a lot of the unknowns and enable us to limit the access of someone who's positive to others.
How close is this more available rapid testing, Dr. Stadler? It sounds like you and Judy, who was with us before us, say it would be really helpful.
Yeah, so we're now just starting to move to this rapid antigen testing. It's just coming out in the last week or so, and we're sort of figuring out how to use it. It is not so whenever we think about any test, we want to think about its ability to accurately find positive cases when they're there, right? So when someone truly has the disease, the test finds it, and accurately rule out or tell us that the disease is not present when it isn't. These rapid tests seem to be much better at ruling in than ruling out. And so we have to sort of figure out how we deal with false positives and false negatives. The false positive rate for the current test that we're using is actually not inconsiderable, particularly when you talk about asymptomatic individuals. It's a much better test when someone is coughing and sneezing or has fever than it is when someone has no symptoms at all.
Oh, that's tough, Dr. Stadler, because we have heard repeatedly on this show that up to 40% of people who are infected with this virus are completely asymptomatic, don't even know they have it. So that's problematic.
Yes, we've had a couple of cases in my facilities of asymptomatic individuals screening positive. We had huge implications on the facility, went back into lockdown, people sent home, and then subsequent testing and antibody testing indicated that it was a false positive and the individual never had COVID.
Oh, it's frustrating. All right. Well, we did have a caller ask why we are not talking with residents themselves. I do want to let that person know that we did a lot of work trying to make that happen. We were not able to pull that off in time for the show today, but we did definitely make an effort there. So your point absolutely is well taken. And if you are living in a long-term care facility, Exchange listeners, here's your opportunity to tell us how it's going for you. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477, or you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to another caller. Mary is in Manchester. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. I was calling. I've been listening, and I haven't heard anything about assisted living facilities, if there's any guidelines for those, if they have the same standard. I know my mom is in one, and they did not do any testing there until probably a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks, when someone of their staff privately tested positive. They had staff members, and they were at that time loosening up the restrictions. And also some concerns about the level of care in those type of facilities, because 6 months is a long time for an older person, can really have a lot of issues, and they don't generally have a doctor there. And if the person has to go out, they're quarantined to their room for 2 weeks, and it's difficult to get them to do that. So I was just wondering if there are any guidelines for assisted living facilities. Thank you.
Sure, because a lot of elders are not in strictly nursing homes. They're in assisted living facilities. So, Mary, I appreciate the question. And Melissa, can you jump in on that question? We sort of touched on it earlier, but different rules and guidance for assisted living facilities.
Sure, happy to. So assisted living facilities are required to follow the licensing regulations as well as the public health guidance that has come out related to phasing and whatnot. So the guidelines that are put out are similar to those that are for nursing homes. You know, there's a different environment in a nursing home compared to assisted living. Many assisted livings have much bigger spaces. The individuals don't share rooms, where in nursing homes, you know, there's a lot of sharing of rooms, a lot of individuals, you know, in a smaller area. So, you know, assisted livings haven't seen the outbreaks that nursing homes have, but obviously are caring for the vulnerable populations are just as important to make sure that, you know, there's proper guidance and regulations around those facilities. So they are, we're following CDC guidelines. We're implementing those in our guidance to ensure that assisted living facilities do have appropriate they do have the appropriate systems in place and are able to continue to protect their residents.
Well, and Doug, Mary's question reminds me about some concerns that you've raised about the state's long-term care ombudsman and her ability to monitor what's going on, whether in nursing homes or in assisted living facilities. So what's the concern there, Doug?
Well, here's the concern is that the long-term care ombudsman is actually a pretty unique kind of program, and what it's really focused on are the needs and rights of the residents and facilities. normally the long-term care ombudsman has a federal mandate to be able to have access to facilities, and in this case, not just nursing homes, but also assisted living facilities as well. They haven't been able to have that access since the beginning of the outbreak. And we think it's really important that they have the opportunity to have access. Now, we recognize that there are safety issues, and we're not suggesting that the ombudsman go in without PPE, without testing, and those sorts of things. But we think that they could play a really important role in helping residents. And from my experience, the long-term care ombudsman is also helpful with facilities. I mean, they have the ability to be able to negotiate things, to mediate things, and to help make things better. And I thought if I could, I would just mention the 800 number for the long-term care ombudsman, because I believe even in the current environment, they can be helpful to families as well. And so that number is 800-442-5640. And I worked with the long-term care ombudsman years ago because I've been involved with long-term care issues, unfortunately, for more years than I care to admit. But they have played a very important role. Another thing I'd like to just touch on briefly is it's my understanding that the recent rules from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services give facilities the ability to get even funding to do to put in like sneeze guards and things for long-term care, for visits in long-term care facilities. So I think, you know, that there's some options there. I think what we ultimately really care about is the ability to balance. You know, we recognize that there are safety issues in facilities, but we've got to balance the needs of residents and families along with that. I think that is critical, especially as we move into the fall. I mean, I know there's been outdoor visitation, but, you know, clearly, you know, last week it got really cold. Well, we've got to warm up now, but we're not going to be able to be doing outdoor visitation, you know, even a month from now, probably. So we really are going to need to have the ability to balance this and be able to take the measures that we need to protect people. And I think that something the long-term care ombudsman's office could be a really big help in terms of moving that forward and helping families and helping facilities, really, quite honestly.
Well, and that number you gave, Doug, we will put it on our website. So like our caller earlier, Marlene in Hinsdale, who was wondering about what she might be able to do, we'll put it on our website. And again, that's nhpr.org/exchange. Well, and you're alluding to something I wanted to ask you anyway, Doug. So everybody who I know who has a loved one in a long-term care facility is concerned about the fall. The outdoor visits have been great, but you're right, they cannot continue, not with our weather here in New Hampshire. So what are your hopes, Doug, as we look ahead to the fall?
I think our hopes are that we are able to adapt the visitations to protect both facilities, but also allow people to come in. And I think, as I just indicated, there's going to be increased funding. For instance, I know that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services allowed facilities to use the state actually to use what's called civil monetary penalty money to provide, iPads and things for the kind of Facebook and things like that that people were doing. Now, I think, as I've indicated, that same kind of funding can be used to allow for certain kinds of equipment that would make it more feasible to have an indoor visit. You know, as you go into stores these days and there's plexiglass, you know, all around, I mean, maybe those are the kinds of things that could be done. I think we're just going to have to be creative and use, you know, the tools that we can develop. I think a lot of it really goes to the fact that this, we know we're in this for the long haul. It seems pretty clear that this isn't going to end in the next several months. And so we've already had 6 or 7 months where visitation has been very limited. The question is, how we can't really go another 7 or 8 months. For some of these people, it's just critical that they have some access. And I think what we're going to have to do from our perspective is do what we can to create safety, but balance the safety with the needs of people. I think that's kind of how I would put it.
You know, last question for you, Doug. Lessons learned for everyone from all this, you know, as you just alluded to, what we've seen in the past 6-7 months, what we are sadly preparing for at least the next couple months, maybe longer. I hate to say that on the air. Lessons learned for everybody, Doug, involved in this, about how long-term care is provided, how it might be made better.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to think about is the nature of the congregate setting and so many people being together. And one of the things that we hope we can look forward to in the future is to look at models where we don't have quite as many people gathered in a setting, so that we could have maybe some smaller models of long-term care facilities that would maybe not provide the same, you know, ability for transmission. That's certainly
more
one
spread
thing.
Out, Doug.
More spread
saying?
Out, and also yeah. Better ability to maintain people in the communities as we move forward. I think those are things. But lastly, I think we're not suggesting the nursing homes aren't doing the best they can. They certainly are. It's just that we need to provide the support right now to make sure that people can get the kind of visitation and support that they need when they're living in those facilities.
Doug, thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Doug McNutt. And coming up, I'll ask our other guests that same question, what the pandemic has taught us about elder care. Plus, more of your stories. Keep sharing them. You can call 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're checking back on Hampshire's long-term care system. New visitation guidelines have been released in recognition of the mental and physical effects on elders of isolation. But as we're hearing, there's a lot of variation around those guidelines. Let's hear from you, your questions and comments, whether you live in a long-term care facility yourself, or you have a loved one there, or you work there. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Dale in Concord is calling in. Hi, Dale. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just wondering if there had been any consideration by those who make all the rules and regulations about the very different populations that have been affected by this in nursing homes. My husband is at Merrimack County Nursing Home, where he's getting wonderful care. But it's been 7 months since I've been able to touch him, sit next to him. His cognitive ability is terrible. And unfortunately, I finally got to see him yesterday because he has been accepted into the hospice program, and he is at end of life. And it's just been, in March, I was visiting him 3 or 4 times a week, and we could sit. He knew me. He could, you know, he knew I was there. He could communicate somewhat. But over the 7 months, he has declined. And I just think that type of population needs to have better guidelines. Could we go in with PPE? Too late for my husband, too late. But for other people who have been in this situation, I'm wondering whether there's been any consideration for that.
Oh, Dale, I'm so sorry. That's so hard for you. And I hope that, you know, whatever time you have left, you can be together more. It's really just heartbreaking to hear your story. I'm so grateful that you called in and shared it. And Dr. Stadler, we really should talk about this. I'm hearing from Dale, you know, facilities need to make more efforts so that these visits are possible. PPE, shields, anything. Go ahead, Dr. Stadler.
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree that we absolutely need to do more. And I hear the tragedy in Dale's story, and I don't think anyone who hears it doesn't want to do something to make it better. I also think we have to remember what it was like several months back. and what this disease does to these facilities. And the not just to the individuals in the facility, but the demonization in the press around these facilities, the reputation and the blame that can happen to these facilities if there's an outbreak. And then to say nothing of the litigation risk to these facilities. So we're gonna have to do something to improve the staffing in these facilities. We're gonna have to do something to protect these facilities from harm if they take these risks. It's one thing to make these guidelines, but you can't really always predict what happens when an outbreak occurs.
Well, and here's an email toward that staffing issue that you raised. John writes, when my mother was in a long-term care facility, she is now passed, I was paying around $6,000 per month, yet I knew many of the staff working there were underpaid. These for-profit facilities are exactly that. So John says, my question is, how much of a contributor was this factor in spreading COVID, since the workers are inclined to work when sick, etc., because they do not have benefits like sick leave? Our frontline workers seem to be woefully underpaid, despite the nice signs we see plastered around. John, I'm so glad you wrote, because Melissa, I read that the $300 sort of extra stipend that was going to long-term care workers to thank them for kind of being on the front lines of this is going away. And so I just wonder what you think about staff pay and the pressure to keep working, even if they're not feeling good.
Yeah, so it is very unfortunate that the $300 pay went away, but it is really, and what you had said earlier about what we kind of have learned since this pandemic began, is that long-term care facilities play a vital role in the care of residents within the state of New Hampshire, but that they have a lot of needs that we need to be able to meet as a state. And so, we need to take them into the fold of the state, really pay attention to them, think about what we can do to make things better in long-term care facilities. And whether that is assisting in staffing or increasing giving them the ability to increase their pay to folks. And those are all things that I think are now at the forefront of many conversations within the state, and unfortunately took the pandemic. Not that the state wasn't discussing this before, but it's come to the forefront of everyone's discussion. So it's something that I think in the future you're going to see a lot more attention paid to the staffing and the their ability to pay folks what they should be paid to do this difficult work.
Yeah, Jean in Nashua also wrote us about that. She says, besides funding and reimbursement issues that work against successful aging, New Hampshire's pathetic $7.25 minimum wage, combined with our high cost of post-secondary education, discourages people from going into direct care services at all levels. Jean says there was a very troubling shortage of healthcare professionals before COVID-19, and now she says it's near catastrophic. What are leaders in the public and private arenas doing to address these problems? And Dr. Stadler, I'll turn to you on that to put on your Dartmouth Hitchcock hat. What do you see happening in sort of the major teaching hospitals and the major healthcare centers about encouraging people to go into these careers, given that the pay isn't great and given that the stresses are many?
Yeah, I will say I've seen some innovative programs that have come out in the last several years through apprenticeship programs and issues works through the Department of Labor to really encourage this work. I will say I have to echo what I've heard. I mean, the staffing issues in the facilities where I work in the months before COVID were at their worst that I've seen in 20 years in this industry. So this is going to take a lot more than just a few months of a $300 supplement. Part of the issue is that these facilities, are bound by such strict regulations. Medicaid in New Hampshire is not exactly a robust payer relative to other states or even just in general. And so If we don't rethink the way we value the care of our frailest members of our community and express that value in the way we reimburse and then the way we train, I don't see a solution.
Last question for you, Dr. Stadler. What's one change, besides the virus going away, obviously, we would all love for that to happen, that would make a world of difference to you and the facilities that you work with?
I think the rapid testing would really be the biggest bang for the buck. If we could test and test almost every day with a quick answer, that would be a huge, huge game.
Yeah, be helpful for all sorts of other organizations too. Schools come to mind and so forth. Both of you, there was so much more we could have talked about, so we'll have to check in again. But for now, we'll wrap it up. And Melissa St. Cyr, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Melissa St. Cyr, Chief Legal Officer for the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. She has a background in nursing home administration. Dr. Daniel Stadler, thank you also for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Stadler, Director of Geriatrics at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and Medical Director at four skilled nursing facilities in the Upper Valley. Today's show was produced by Senior Producer Ellen Grimm. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.